From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
I'm from Cleveland Heights.
West Oakland, California.
I think my landlord marketed it to me as Temescal, but it's actually Golden Gate.
Coming up, we'll look into a small solution to the big problem of homelessness.
I think there are plenty of people who would rather live in a tiny home than live in a tent or live out on the streets.
Then it's been 6 years since the Affordable Care Act was signed. So what's changed?
We're seeing improvements in life expectancy, where that gap between blacks and whites is at its narrowest that it's ever been.
And a musician grapples with having to leave her country behind.
The last question is, how can I make my land forgive me?
Home, health, and safety. Today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. We're starting today with the next installment of our series on public safety in the Bay Area, a project by the students of KALW's Audio Academy Journalism Training Program.
What does public safety mean to you?
The city is not prepared unless everyone in the city is prepared for disaster.
So you owe a person sex if you've been flirting with them?
No.
It's really about stabilizing your entire life.
Last month, San Francisco city workers cleared a large tent encampment of homeless people on Division Street. The public health department had declared the area a public health hazard. The city offered beds at a new shelter at Pier 80, but many of the displaced tent residents simply moved their belongings to surrounding alleys, where conditions are arguably as unsafe as they were on Division Street. It's another suggestion that shelters are not a viable solution for everyone. So here's another experimental solution, tiny homes for the homeless. KLW's True Nguyen explains.
When I met Chris Turkilly, he and his husband were living in a tent under the overpass on Division Street in San Francisco.
For now, it is what it is, and I'm doing my best to, you know, like, keep it tidy and keep it as normalized as possible.
Before this, the two lived in an apartment in Novato. But problems with heroin addiction spiraled until they ended up on the streets. Here's Trokili's husband, Phoenix Garvey.
And honestly, that's the only thing, that's the main factor in us still being here. We'd love to be inside, we'd love to, you know, be doing the everyday drive, but it's our addiction, you know?
The young couple sat on a mattress that took up almost the entire space. On one side of the tent was a small shelf with toothbrushes, toothpaste, soap. In another corner, a milk crate served as a paper towel dispenser. Everything seemed to be in its proper place, but for a homeless person, that sense of security can be fragile. Just 2 days before, all their stuff had been stolen.
So literally everything you're looking at, we've gotten within the last 48 hours, literally from picking stuff up off the ground.
Without shelter and with only the clothes they were wearing, the two walked around that night until they found a blanket.
And we laid down in that alley and wrapped ourselves in the comforter.
After one night out in the open, they lucked out when a friend, another homeless person, gave them an old tent. Although he was grateful for that help, Trokili said getting involved with people can be a safety issue.
The homeless community is like, it almost seems like everybody knows everybody. Sometimes that could be a concern because, I mean, if one person knows that, say, you made $50 by helping out an old lady doing whatever, you know, like, next thing you know, your tent could be trashed.
Faced with theft, violence, and unsanitary conditions, Thurkili and his husband are the prime demographic for what many are calling a new solution to homelessness, tiny homes. You may have seen this idea being embraced by middle-class Americans, like on the TV show Tiny House Nation, now in its fourth season.
The average American home is 2,300 square feet, but lots of people are deciding that bigger isn't necessarily better, and they're choosing to live in homes that are just one-tenth the average size.
That's more like 200 square feet. Tiny homes being built for the homeless are generally under 100 square feet, about the size of a bathroom. Some are prefab using regular building supplies, and some are made from found materials, like old furniture, sheet metal, and wood pallets. And while the people on the TV show talk about downsizing from a big house, for someone literally living on the street, any structure with four walls and a door can be a real step up.
It's one idea in a set of tools in a toolbox.
Shirley Zane is a county supervisor in Sonoma. She's leading a pilot project to provide transitional housing using tiny homes built on public property.
The board thought it was a great idea, and the public thought it was a great idea.
Her office got more than 30 applications from developers interested in building the tiny homes through a public-private partnership.
We're looking at a very small space right now, and I think between 10 and 20, and not more than that.
There's actually a model for this type of thing. A permanent tiny home settlement called Dignity Village in Portland, Oregon, has been successfully housing homeless people since 2004. Sonoma's tiny homes will be within 30 feet of the Human Resources Department. Nearby bus lines can get you to downtown Santa Rosa in less than 15 minutes.
I think there are plenty of people who would rather live in a tiny home than live in a tent or live out on the streets.
She may be right, but not everyone can get behind the tiny home idea. Stacy Murphy has been developing housing programs for over 20 years. She's the Director of Strategic Initiatives at Abode Services in Oakland, a nonprofit housing and service provider.
If it's not permanent, and if it's not stable, it's hard to see that as a long-term solution.
Murphy says when looking for solutions to homelessness, there's one critical thing to consider.
All of this takes place in the larger context of a fundamental lack of affordable housing at all affordability levels.
The National Low Income Housing Coalition notes that between 1976 and 2002, the U.S. housing and urban development's budget dropped by 59%. Since 1981, it has only risen above 2% once.
At the time that the U.S. government backed away from funding housing, homelessness didn't really exist as a problem. So they disinvested from housing. That's a shift.
Murphy says we often think of homelessness as a local problem because that's where we see it, on the streets. But the lack of housing is a national problem.
And so what you see then at the local level are cities and jurisdictions that are scrambling.
Is there a real and cost-effective solution to homelessness? Murphy says yes, and it's an approach called Housing First. Previously, it was assumed that people needed to be, quote, ready for housing before receiving it, meaning free of addiction or mental health issues, or already employed.
And what happens then is people spend a lot of time trying to manage the things that contribute to homelessness before they're in housing. Many years ago, a few sort of innovative providers realized that that was not the right way to think about the problem.
Housing itself is a form of healthcare, Murphy says. It wasn't until 1998 that San Francisco's Department of Public Health began providing permanent housing instead of only providing services to people living on the street.
And they put them immediately into permanent, stable, safe, affordable housing. And the results were dramatic.
From 2002 to 2005, the number of homeless people in San Francisco dropped by 28%. But the rising cost of real estate, combined with limited government funding, means that Housing First doesn't necessarily translate to people actually getting housed. From 2005 to 2015, the number of homeless people in San Francisco rose 7%.
I am concerned about the future of homelessness here in the Bay Area because as we see housing prices increasingly spiral, and the rental market is out of control. I don't know where folks are going to go.
After the city started clearing the tents on Division Street, Chris Thurkilly didn't know where he would go.
I think I'm going to go sit at a park and just meditate for a minute, clear my head, and figure out exactly what direction I want to go.
Unfortunately, this is a familiar feeling for him.
I mean, that's how the last 22 years of my 22 years of existence have been, you know, just second by second.
Homeless advocates like Stacy Murphy don't want to discourage creative solutions to homelessness. But she says we already know what works, permanent, stable housing. And tiny homes are not, it's that lack of permanent housing that keeps people like Chris Thurkilly on the street. I'm True Gwynn for Cross Currents.
True Gwynn is a student reporter in KALW's Audio Academy. Would you like to be part of it? We're accepting applications now through March 31st. Head to KALW.org for all the details. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. 6 years ago today, the Affordable Care Act was signed into law, Obamacare. The goal was to make healthcare accessible to all Americans and to focus on eliminating disparities based on income, education, gender, and race. Things like heart disease, diabetes, lower birth rates, and life expectancy rates are more common in Black and Brown populations. But has the ACA been able to make a dent in these problems yet? KALW's Leela Day sat down with Dr. Nadine Gracia, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health, to find out what's changed.
And what we've seen actually since the law has been passed is that 20 million Americans have actually gained coverage. And people of color have actually made some significant gains with regards to access to health coverage. We've seen, for example, that among African American adults since 2013, that the uninsured rate for African American adults has actually declined by 53%, resulting in 3 million African American adults gaining coverage. Mm-hmm. When you look at the Latino community, among Latino adults, their uninsured rate has actually declined 27%, resulting in about 4 million Latino adults gaining coverage. So we've made really important gains with regards to access to coverage, which certainly is also bringing peace of mind and security to so many families across the country.
It seems like lately there's been a shift from talking about healthcare disparities to talking now about social determinants. What does that mean, and why are we shifting the conversation right now? Why do you think we are?
Well, I think it's important to understand that disparities exist in health and healthcare, and we're actually working to address all of those elements. And so our health is not only influenced by what happens in a healthcare setting, not only influenced by what happens in a doctor's office or in the hospital, but that also our health is also influenced by other determinants, the conditions in which we live and where we work, where children play and have the ability to play, that all of those other determinants also play a critical role in health. So when we think about issues such as poverty or access to quality education, transportation, and having access to quality and affordable foods, nutritious foods in the community, those are also important areas. And so that means that to effectively address health disparities, that we have to work across sectors. So in health, education, transportation, and other sectors to be able to improve the health and well-being of all communities.
Mm-hmm. So this sounds like it's more of a grassroots effort as well. I mean, we can have the law that's signed into effect to give people more access to health care, but there's also this boots on the ground sort of educational element as well. How is the Affordable Care Act addressing that need?
With the Affordable Care Act, there have also been investments made, for example, in navigators who are helping people connect and getting access to coverage, but also connections to care. And we have been working with partners all across the country, community organizations, faith-based organizations, and others to help do that outreach and education as trusted voices in the community.
Mm-hmm. And one of the programs is a program that's at the YMCA.
Could you tell us
about what that's about?
Yes. So actually today, we're just announcing actually the success of a diabetes prevention program, which has been implemented through the YMCA. We have seen that by actually working within communities and actually addressing things such as access to healthy foods and physical activity, that we've seen actually declines in body weight, such that people have actually decreased their risk for their risk of diabetes and diabetic complications. So showing that by making these types of investments in innovative models of care and care coordination, that we can actually reduce healthcare costs, but also improve quality of health. And so that's an exciting announcement for us today, showing that these types of investments and innovations actually can make a difference when we look at chronic conditions like diabetes.
This is Cross Currents. I'm talking to Dr. Nadine Gracia, the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health. One thing I think that's often overlooked when we're talking about healthcare is mental health. And one fact is that there's so many men of color who are incarcerated who actually have mental illnesses, yet it's not something that's treated as equal as maybe having diabetes or a heart condition. Do you see the Affordable Care Act will start embracing mental illness as a serious health concern?
So actually, and that's a great question, because we know that our mental health and well-being is part of our overall health and well-being, and the Affordable Care Act actually is already making a difference in that area. For example, when you look at the health insurance plans that are part of the health insurance marketplace, that actually coverage for behavioral health services is part of the essential health benefits.
Because it wasn't before.
Right, and so the Affordable Care Act has now instituted that into the qualified health plans, that having access to behavioral health services, being a part of the qualified health plans as one of the essential health benefits, is a key component. The Affordable Care Act is actually expanding coverage. It's the largest coverage expansion as it relates to behavioral health services. Over 60 million Americans who are now getting access to those coverage and services. We also have what we call parity when it comes to payment with regards to behavioral health services and the physical health services, if you will, and medical and surgical services. So actually, the Affordable Care Act really is one of the most important laws we've seen also to help in moving forward with that equality, if you will, between behavioral health and our medical and surgical needs.
Mm-hmm. So let's look on the positive side. You know, what should we be proud of, especially people of color, mm-hmm. in terms of our health and well-being?
Well, one, I would say we're at a historic low, as I mentioned, with regards to the rate of uninsurance. We're seeing improvements in life expectancy, where that gap between blacks and whites is at its narrowest that it's ever been. We've been making gains, for example, in HIV, with regards to reductions in HIV rates, with black women experiencing some of the sharpest declines in HIV rates. We're investing $11 billion in community health centers, mm-hmm. and community health centers see about 23 million patients, and of those patients, nearly two-thirds are minorities. And so we know that's an important safety net, an important service and access for communities of color to get the care and services that they need.
That was Dr. Nadine Gracia from the Office of Minority Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Find more reporting on health at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Berkeley-based singer-songwriter Diana Gameros comes from Ciudad Juarez, a Mexican border town ripped apart by violent drug cartels. She hasn't been home in 13 years. Her family and friends tell her things are getting better there, but she has to wait for her immigration status to become finalized before she can find out for herself. In the meantime, she's made the Bay Area her home, singing about the longing and joy that come from having a life in two worlds at once.
So this is called Cómo Hacer. It's a song that I wrote that came out of my need for wisdom, for home, and for forgiveness.
¿Cómo hacer que la vida perdure?
I just pose the questions knowing that it's okay to not have answers.
Que nada ni nadie escase. Si nadie es eterno, nada es nuestro.
How could we make life last if nothing is ours, nothing is eternal? How can I make the walker fly?
¿Cómo hacer que el que camina vuele?
How can I make the borders dissolve so that he can walk freely?
¿Cómo hacer que las fronteras se evaporen y caminar sin prisa al hogar?
And without fear to his or her home.
Sin miedo.
Most of my songs have, you know, they present this this issue, if you want to call it, or this, they present this circumstance or this topic, and there's always a happy or hopeful resolution to it.
hacer que mi tierra me perdone? ¿Cómo hacer para que su jardín ya vuelva?
The last question is, how can I make my land forgive me?
Y hacerle saber que lejos.
How do I tell her that it's hard to have to be away from her?
Decirle también que vivo por volver a verle.
I realize, especially being in California, you know, having such high numbers of Latinos and immigrants and undocumented immigrants and you know, everything that goes on in the Bay Area and in California in particular, inspired me a lot to sing about the things that were personal but also felt that could speak to, you know, to a greater audience and or to other people that could relate to what I was writing, what I was feeling. It's okay to not have answers all the time to the questions you pose. It's important to put them out there, and answers will come eventually.
¿Cómo hacer que la vida perdure?
Diana Gameros will be performing her show called Musical Reflection on Love, Migration, and Identity. That's Saturday at the Red Poppy Art House in San Francisco's Mission District. Want local performance recommendations to come straight to your phone in time to plan for the show? Subscribe to our Cross Currents podcast. You can even search our shows by subject. Find out how at kalw.org/subscribe. It's because of you that we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Luisa Cardoza, Lila Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, James Rowland, Stephen Short, and Eli Wertschafter. Today's show was engineered by Ted Muldoon. The line producer was Liza Feel. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We meet BART police officers reaching out to the homeless people resting in their stations.
It's definitely a bigger battle than what law enforcement can come up with a remedy.
A different approach to policing tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News. This music is by Todos Santos. They're from Marin County, but their name comes from a village in Baja, where they got their start. Todos Santos call their sound Cantina Americana, and you can hear them live at Perry's Bar in Fairfax, Friday evening at 5:30.
You feel like the weight of the world is sitting on your head. See only troubles around you, toss and turn all night in your bed. But just look at the palm tree, with coconuts so big and round, they seem like they must be a bird.